Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 162.
That's a lot of episodes.
Thank you, Lon. This is a big one for me. This is something that I've actually been wanting to do for well over a year, maybe two. It was the first time I met this person, whose name is Alex McDowell. I saw him at a keynote, and it was here in LA for the Immerse VR conference that happened in Hollywood that I think is sponsored by Unity. And it was amazing. And the minute I heard him talk about what he was doing, I said, he is my kindred spirit, because he understood the ideas of the importance of environments in terms of world creation. And that's basically what he does, is world building. But he is an incredible person. Lon, what have you found out about Alex as we were talking about this?
Well, I mean, I could see why he's your kindred spirit, right? It's architecture, it's film, it's VR, it's world building, and the impact that environment has on the experience you have and all of these different things.
Yes.
And of course, Alex is probably most known for the work that he's done on Minority Report and in the world there, which he talks about the kind of genesis of that whole concept, which is absolutely amazing. Mm-hmm. And then of course, you know, Fight Club and other films. I actually just recently found out that he was a production designer on the movie The Crow.
Yes.
Which, if anybody knows me and my movie tastes, mm-hmm. that's one of my favorite movies of all time. So I just, you know, kind of fanboying out on that.
Yeah, he's really incredible. And I think I'm just trying to give you guys a little bit of a taste of what we talk about, and it's related to Minority Report. But he mentions on Minority Report that he and the scriptwriter were hired on the same day, meaning there was no script, and he designed the world with no script, and the script happened or was heavily inspired by the world that Alex created, and so he sees the world being built as an inspiration for, especially in science fiction, where you have no concept of what the world is, right?
It could be anything.
Instead of framing the world through the frame of the camera, he frames it as the entire world, like build the entire world and then frame the camera. And I think that's a beautiful way to look at it. And so what I want to make sure people understand is this is not a podcast that's just for people making films. This is a podcast that's important to the architects as well, because they do this all the time.
Yeah. Right? And I mean, for anybody too, like he talks about stories of, you know, designing posters for the Sex Pistols and like crazy, you know, amazing life experiences that he kind of draws you right in and you feel like you were there. So it kind of covers everything.
Yeah, I've had some amazing podcasts on where you hear these backstories of people that you just sort of blow your mind. And this one is one of the top ones I've ever had, because this guy has gone through some life experiences that are incredible and that we should all look on. And he's very, very humble about it, because he says, I just stumble into these situations, or I fail forward in some ways. Mm-hmm. But you don't fail forward that many times without having incredible talent, you know? So it's really, really cool that he's that. So I really think that everyone who listens to this podcast from all levels, all industries should really enjoy it. It's really great. Let's talk about a couple of announcements. Let's talk about a few things coming up. The first thing I want to tell, I want you to mention is Total Chaos.
Yeah, it's a big, I cannot wait until we get everybody in Sofia and I can say, welcome to Total Chaos. I'm looking forward to that exact moment in time, but this is going to be our biggest event ever. It's our biggest event to date.
Yep.
In years past, we've had an event called CG Squared.
Yes.
And we held it over two weekends. So one weekend was for developers, and then mm-hmm. the next weekend was for artists. Mm-hmm. And we got the great idea to combine the two into one big weekend, invite about 1,000 people to our, you know, what I call our secret lair in Sofia.
Yep.
And We're bringing in speakers from all over the world to talk about the latest and greatest stuff that they're working on from a variety of different things. It's, you know, it's VFX and film and television, but it's also automotive, product design, architecture.
Yep.
Just a little bit of everything, as well as tech experts and programmers and developers and so on. So it should be 2 days of, well, of total chaos.
Actually. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's really great because, you know, the word CG is computer and graphics, right? So if you take, you know, the computer part of it and you take the developers that make these tools and then you take the guys that use those tools, it's kind of an amazing thing to combine them and see how the two can understand each other in a really interesting way.
Well, it's also a really great opportunity to have conversations where, you know, you put artists and developers in the room and there's ideas that float around. They go, well, could you do this? Or how could we make this happen? And suddenly, you know, new ideas are spawned from that or new technology comes out of it. So I think it's going to be a great opportunity.
And where can people find out more about this?
So you'll be able to find out about it on the website.
Yep.
Right underneath our event section.
Right. And I think it's chaosgroup.com/total-chaos, I believe is what the... But we'll double check.
Yeah, that. Or go to chaosgroup.com and click on events, and it should be the top one that shows up.
Yeah. So, and what's the dates?
May 18th and 19th.
Okay.
So put it on your calendar.
Yep.
Come out to Sophia. Enjoy, you know, the tech park, which is where we're having it.
It's actually a beautiful time to be in Sophia in May. Yeah. Yeah. So
as opposed to when, you know, the winter time when we were just
there. Yeah, we were just there. It was a little cold. Yeah. But, you know, a little rakia and you feel warmed up.
makes everything better.
If you don't know what rakia is, it's this delicious brandy that's made in Sofia that is actually really delicious.
Well, so, you have to come to Total Chaos and find out. We'll get you some.
There's some really good things you can do. The great tastes of Sofia, including the incredible Bulgarian yogurt and the incredible sausages and all the different things that they have there. It's a really great place to be.
Non sequitur, but one of the main bacteria in, like, the good bacteria in yogurt,
yes,
is named after Bulgaria. It's Bulgaricus.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, well, there you go. And if you like yogurt, come to Bulgaria. All right, guys. Thanks a lot. And hopefully you guys will enjoy this amazing podcast with Alex McDowell.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
I've heard of your work and I've been studying a lot of the stuff you've done, but it's really kind of comes from so many different angles from what I could tell. And I think the best way to sort of start would be to talk a little bit about how you ended up where you are and some of the origins. And I know that you were, where were you born?
Yeah, I was born in Borneo. My dad was an engineer, chief engineer for Shell.
Okay.
And I'm guessing Shell had a policy of moving their people on every 4 years. But it was very much that sort of colonial space that I was brought up in, where Shell would drop a kind of camp down. They would call it a camp, but essentially build a bunch of bungalows around a golf course and then, you know, next to a giant oil field.
Right.
You know, it was a strange way to grow up, and I was in this space somewhere between Western civilization and the jungle, I guess. In Indonesia was where I spent my early childhood, and then I went to boarding school very quickly, which was again a tradition for a middle class British family whose parents were traveling a lot. Mm-hmm. Both my parents went to boarding school, so I went to a single sex boarding school, Quaker boarding school, from age 7 to 18, to two different schools.
And was that in the UK?
That was back in the UK.
And so then you traveled home, right? So,
yeah. And it was an odd thing that the company would only pay for two round trip flights a year. So one holiday I would spend with my grandparents in London or Bromley, outside London. And then the other two, I would go to my parents. And so they would continue to move, went from Indonesia to Trinidad. And so I used to go to the Caribbean for a while, I think till I was about 12.
Right.
And then my dad got posted back to the UK to do North Sea Gas, mm-hmm. and was in East Anglia, east coast of Britain. And then finally in Wales to do a pipeline across the north of Wales. Terribly un-PC.
but how did that influence sort of the things that you were doing? You obviously were interested in art or creative fields at that time. So what got you into that?
You know, my memory is that in my public school, which was from age 12 on, No, that's not true. I think in younger, when I was 10, I had an art teacher I liked, and she told me I was good at art, and that was kind of it.
Right.
I needed probably the approval, and I drilled into that and just decided I was going to be an artist.
Right.
And really from that point on, that was really all I was interested in. When the rest of my fellow boarding school friends were applying for colleges, I was just applying for art school. Mm. And art school sort of drove me to London. I was very lucky to get into to one of the London art schools.
Right.
I used to draw, and I was good at drawing, and I got accepted on my drawing abilities. Mm-hmm. And I guess I thought I was going to be an artist, but then music hit, and I think music has been the kind of overriding influence actually on my career.
Oh, really? So how did music happen to you?
Yeah, well, so I was, you know, we were in the middle of London, and I was actually the social secretary at my college, which meant I booked the bands.
Okay.
And so I was in my, you know, band booking office.
Right.
With my friend Sebastian Conran, the two of us were, who was the son of the Conran dynasty. Mm-hmm. A young man walked in off the street and asked if we wanted a band to play for free tomorrow night, mate. and so we went to see them that night play at St. Martin's, which was the closest other art school.
Right.
They were supporting and they were kicked off the stage. So the night they played at Central was the Sex Pistols first gig.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
So I it was kind of, you know, ridiculous cliche. It just, my life changed in that moment. I mean,
right.
I went from wearing drape jackets and crepe shoes, which we were all into, like, mm-hmm. 50s rock and roll up until that moment.
Right.
To sort of, you know, dyeing my hair and sort of trying to work out how to piece together punk clothing, and told Malcolm McLaren I'd like to work with them, and went in the very early back of the trucks up to back of their van. We drove to Paris for their first gig. Uh-huh. As I was their photographer for about 2 months until my photographs were so bad that people like Neil Stevenson took that role on, quite rightly. But I was just determined to work in music from that point on, really, and to work around the band. So it was, you know, it's hard to imagine the effect of this raw energy that just stood up on stage at that point, you know, mostly other than, I mean, Glenn Matlock, who continues to be a good friend, was the guy who came in and asked if we wanted them to play.
Right,
was a good musician, and I think Steve and Paul were, but they, you know, they were very much at the beginning of their abilities, and so it was nothing to do with anything that we'd heard before in terms of whether music was. Skillful. It was obviously entirely to do with this revolutionary attitude that was coming, you know, exploding off the stage. This sort of sense of there is nothing you cannot do.
Right.
And in the, and very, I mean, it was, you know, it's born out of anarchistic situationalists, situationists and highly political with Jamie Reid and Malcolm McLaren's kind of background, and obviously deeply embedded in fashion and deeply embedded in the street and in working class politics. And and so I had, you know, I couldn't have come from a more different backdrop, completely cocooned, you know, in a, inside these public schools that were, you know, called public schools, private single-sex boarding schools, completely isolated. I barely knew how a city functioned, let alone anything kind of cultural. And so it was a head-on assault that I responded to incredibly. It was very much in line with kind of where I was interested in politically, and the idea of self-determination and sort of or supported by revolution, you know, and the possibility of change and being at the center of change and seeing that change happen in real time. Right. Constantly.
Because it's not just about music, as you said, it was a change in culture that
absolutely
happened at that moment.
Deeply cultural.
Right.
And it was aligned with, well, you know, and driven by the politics in London at that time. Where you had
Thatcher. What year was this approximately?
No, it was 75.
Okay, wow.
And so by 76, punk was on the front of, newspapers. Yep. And we were squatting. I lived in a squat that was 10 houses in a row in this town called Stoke Newington in North London region. And all of the backyards had been knocked down into a communal living between these houses, and holes cut in walls between every house.
So that they can just make it a one continuous house in a sense.
Well, sort of kind of Beatles, you know, going in four different doors and then meeting. Right. And, except it was really so that if the police raided one house, everyone could get out, escape to the next house and come out the other one. Right. And, you know, where the you know, we weren't paying any rent, and any bills were being passed on to every new person that came in, took on the bill and then passed it to the next person. So no bills were ever paid.
Right.
So it was this, you know, and Thatcher and Ken Livingstone and very, actually very impoverished London, a lot of tension, IRA bombs going, you know, it was a radical time.
Yeah.
And for me, it was just possibility, you know, it was just like anything could be, created. So I started printing T-shirts for Vivienne Westwood. We printed all of the shirts for Sex and Seditionaries and the Pistols and Jamie Reid's designs and Vivienne's designs for three or four years. I formed a T-shirt company called State Arts. And Glenn Matlock, when he left the Pistols, asked me to design a record sleeve for him for the Rich Kids.
Right.
So we formed a graphic design company called Rocking Russian. And at some point we had a record company called Three Clicks. I think I can't even remember what we released, but we released one single. But again, it was just like we just kind of got on with it. I've never actually been employed in my life except for 2 years at DreamWorks as an employee, but I've always been freelance. I've always had that sense of being able to be self-determining.
That's amazing, and that stems from that original part of you, right?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. I don't know if I was primed for it. I feel like it was that I had been. It was such a extreme difference to my upbringing,
right?
That I was just ripe for it. But you know, as were many, you know, the amount of people who dove towards punk because it was finally something real and something. That was close to an expression of the way that we were feeling. I mean, I feel like what we were doing at art school, if we had been as organized as the, what were they called? The Damien Hirst group.
Okay.
The young, you know, at that point, which didn't come out till the 80s, but right. the group of artists who were working in this kind of impoverished art school that whose teachers were all failed artists and who basically welcomed us by saying, you know, you'll never work, you'll never get work in this, you'll never make money doing art, so see you in 3 years, was basically their approach. So we were doing, I think, some really interesting and radical art that was going on. My final show, by which time I'd sort of embraced punk in my art as well. So my show was as provocative as I could make it at the time, and mm-hmm. was torn down by the vice principal when he came around with his family because he was a good Christian man and was so insulted by my work that I had a big drawing that was like 10 foot square that he ripped up in the middle of the show.
Right.
Again, you know, like of kind of...
It certainly was provocative then.
We wouldn't have wasted that opportunity a couple of years later to get a lot of press out of it, but right. as it turned out, it got me a job at ID Magazine. I joined...
Oh, wow, okay.
Terry Jones had just left Vogue as art director and decided to start a fanzine. I mean, the most radical, again, crazy
right.
Thing to do. And I was co-editor for the first four issues of ID Magazine, which were literally Xeroxed and stapled.
Wow.
It just, you know, has obviously turned into yeah. an institution, but it just, you know, I have been so lucky in my life and my career to sort of fall off one cliff and into opportunity into another, into one opportunity after another, just sort of falling forward. But it was just, in a way, one just expected it to be that way. It just was, it was kind of ridiculous that Terry would have gone to my show right at the time when it was creating a stir and decided he wanted me to be there to help him with ID. But each of those things, that along with the graphics company, I was a terrible graphic designer, but there were so few of us that, you know, you worked. And right. then I was designing Iggy Pop's Soldier campaign because Glenn was in his band at that time,
right.
and invited Iggy to come to our studio to design the campaign. And Iggy asked if we knew anyone who made music videos. And so we said, we'll do, you know, I didn't actually know what a music video was, but
right.
The first film work I ever did, I was already production designer because we were in charge of our own.
Right.
We were the team. We hired a great photographer called Brian Griffin mm-hmm. to be the cinematographer, and a young director called Nick May, who was just out of arts film school, and myself, and we just made it up as we went along, but we happened to be in the second wave of music videos, so there was just kind of Godly and Cream. There were probably less than half a dozen video directors when we started with that Iggy video.
Right.
And Iggy had just heard that music videos were what you should do, so he said, I think we made three videos for £3,000.
Wow.
But again, it just sort of catapulted me forward, and then I ended up or started doing as much music video work as graphics.
Right. And that got you into the film idea and understanding yeah. the process and production and all of that.
Absolutely. I knew nothing about film, mm-hmm. But we had this amazing opportunity at that time to kind of make it up as we went along and essentially invent a new medium, because for it since the union in the UK at the time, which unfortunately got, you know, ripped apart in Thatcher era, mm-hmm. Refused to acknowledge music videos as a form. And so you couldn't, so there was no structure around the way we made music videos then, because we couldn't tap into the existing film industry.
Right.
So I eventually teamed up first with one director called Tim Pope, who is an amazing inspirational kind of naive filmmaker who made all the Cure videos, and I worked on six of those.
Oh, wow.
For the Banshees, and then but increasingly more and more commercial work.
Right.
So Tim got more and more commercial work, and then I worked with a director called Peter Kerr. Peter Kerr started getting work in the States, and so we used to come over here every, you know, couple of months, I probably.
Mm-hmm.
Since from about the late 80s. No, probably no. Actually, probably like from 82 onwards, I was coming to the States.
Okay. Mostly to the East Coast, I'm assuming, or
no, all to the West Coast.
Oh, to West Coast.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Peter and I were both obsessed with the desert, so we used to come and shoot music videos in, you know, around Joshua Tree, Palms, and come over and then go back, and elsewhere. We shot Depeche Mode in Berlin at the Wall before the Wall came down, which was an amazing experience.
Wow.
I have this memory, and it can't really be true, but it seems that I smuggled smoke bombs on the plane to Berlin so that we had colored smoke in the video.
Okay.
It seems completely unlikely that would have happened, but either way, we were letting off smoke, smoke bombs for colored smoke right by the Wall.
Wow.
And so we'd have these crazy exploits because videos were completely free form and an incredibly creative form. You almost by default you had to come up with a new idea, you know, two or three times a week.
And this was at the height of like the most creative music videos, when the MTV era revolution and all of that stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was right at the beginning of MTV. Mm-hmm. It was this first wave, really, of music video directors before the sort of Spike Jonze kind of wave.
Right.
But a lot of them born out of graphics. Anton Corbin, for example, who was shooting stills for record sleeves and then started doing music videos. Nick Knight and people like that who would move from back and forth between photography and video. And as I say, I was working with this company, Limelight. We were getting a lot of commercial work. We did, Neil Young and Queen, and it got more and more commercial. And then I came to LA to do a Bananarama video, and they canceled it for some reason, but we ended up doing another video for a guy called Robbie Neville, and it was a hit. So we came in on, you know, as you would do, I sort of come in on Monday, write the video, shoot it on Wednesday. It would go out on Saturday onto MTV.
Wow.
And then it was a hit on Monday, and we stayed, and we never went back.
Wow.
And so that was 86.
Wow.
And that again sort of shifted everything for me, because then I was right in the heart of this new industry. Mm-hmm. And joined a company called Propaganda fairly soon after that, I want to say. I can't remember what the timing was on that, but by that time I was working with David Fincher and mm-hmm. worked every day for 7 days a week for a year with him. Doing, and as he transitioned from music videos to commercials, did that whole transition with him from Paula Abdul to Madonna to the amazing Don Henley video he did, and then into Converse and these commercials that were getting more and more successful. And by the time we were in the middle of Propaganda, I guess we were somewhat in the center of attention. At that point, I was asked to production design a film called Lawnmower Man.
Yeah.
And that's sort of, again, somewhat out of the blue, because that's Brett Leonard.
Right.
Who has remained a good friend, but he came out of the science community in San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
but I think saw an opportunity with this Stephen King book to use it to talk about this new phenomenon called virtual reality.
Right. Which is becoming important again.
Which strangely, because that was 1990.
Yeah.
And it failed dismally at the time, because actually mostly because of hygiene is my theory, because the headsets were so expensive that they had to be in a in a public space, public right. use. And people didn't want to put other people's headsets on.
Right.
I think that killed the industry at that time.
Interesting. Well, I think also now, obviously, the technology has changed a lot. That you become, yes, like you said, like you don't, people can buy their own. But it's a fascinating thing. But I want to sort of figure out, if you can help me, how did your interest in architecture and environment and world building develop from that process? Because there's a transition there, because you have a special, something fascinating to me. When I saw your talk at the, I think it was called Immerse, I was like, that's, he's speaking my language. He's saying something that I've been saying for so long. And I really am fascinated by your fascination with environment and how that develops narrative in some way.
Yeah, so it's, I mean, certainly I wasn't primed for this in terms of career or anything. I think right. I was coming out of, you know, a kind of planar approach to art, you know, mm-hmm. drawing in a 2D flat surface. So I think it sort of snuck up on me. I believe that I am where I am because I am intensely curious and very easily bored. And I think I've been thinking about this because I'm a huge fan of David Bowie, and I was looking back at his career and thinking there's something I can relate to very closely, which is this desire to dive deeply into different kind of genres and different kind of spaces in a very broad pop cultural way. And then to sort of exhaust that in a way, and then move quickly into the next and into the next, into the next. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, I think it's characteristic or you know, it's part of my personality to be driven to move deeply into something immersively through mm-hmm. the curiosity, but be ready to move on almost immediately unless it really engages me.
Sure.
But to kind of, so, and what I think I love still, but loved certainly for the last 30 years of doing production design, is that it's very different from other kind of design mm-hmm. work in that your signature is your lack of a recognizable silhouette in a way.
Okay.
In other words, the great production designers are not disappear into the space that they build.
Okay.
And that also, that suits me well as well, which is to immerse yourself entirely into the fabric of this space. Mm-hmm. And rather than try and develop a style, which I kind of fundamentally don't believe in, the mm-hmm. idea of style as a design characteristic. So I've come at architecture, as fascinated as I am, my brother's an architect, and mm-hmm. I feel like I've always been really interested by it, but I'm interested in it as environment, I suppose, as a space within which people are located and within which story takes place. And so I think I'm fundamentally not an architect in that I think architects on the whole develop careers that are about creating recognizable silhouettes in order to get the next job. Mm-hmm. And that's a horrible kind of oversimplification, but I think that there's a sense of architecture as a as an object, mm-hmm. as a thing, you know, that you create. And I'm really interested in the kind of invisible connection between people and story and place.
Right.
And so that's sort of long-windedly a way of saying that the combination of production design needing to subsume yourself to the narrative mm-hmm. and to serve the narrative and to disappear as a designer, and that the great production designer supports a story and creates environments that are so seamless that you no longer recognize them, I would say. Mm-hmm. Along with what developed for me over the early years of doing production design, where I realized that there's this powerful triangular relationship between a person, place, and point of view.
Okay.
And that it's very clear in film.
Whose point of view? The
camera in
camera.
Film terms.
Okay, so
although ones have, you know, I've thought a lot about this, especially in relation to, say, the relationship between film and game. So the difference between subjective or first person and third person inside this environment is interesting. And, but, you know, kind of easy to distinguish that you can say that the first job of the storyteller, or at least that every story contains that volatile kind of triangular relationship, that every story is about people in place with a specific point of view.
When I was in architecture school, I was fascinated by the concept of narrative, especially with architecture. And I knew that, you know, architecture tells a story and there's different things going on. And it took me years and years to figure out why I was fascinated by this. And I don't think I was able to make the connection until more recently. And it's related to VR. The reason architecture or environments, it doesn't have to be architecture, but when I was dealing with architecture, the narrative is first person. It is the way you experience space is a first person experience. And in filmmaking, it's a third person experience. You're experiencing someone else's story, generally speaking. That's a valid narrative. But architects tell that by the nature of their very job, tell a story of your experience within that space. And they do that every day when they present their spaces. And the really good ones do a very good job of telling that narrative. But that narrative is also a non-linear narrative because it's you can experience in any way that you choose to, and that's the whole point. And that's a means of communication in terms of space that I find fascinating. And what frustrates me in the VR world sometimes is that a lot of people are trying to thrust a third-person narrative into an experience that really should be a first-person experience. And I think that the architecture and the environment designers are the ones that really understand that. And when I was listening to some of your talks, especially when I was listening to some of the talks you gave on the Minority Report on how that came to be designed, I was like, that's exactly what I'm trying to explain, is like the narrative formed itself out of this experience. Can you tell people about that experience of how that narrative and space all came together? Because I think it's brilliant.
Well, I completely agree with you. I think that the idea that environment triggers narrative, that's the best kind of architecture.
Right.
I totally agree. I think that the disadvantage, and one sees it fail badly in some of the great architecture, like Corbusier, L'Habitation, for example, where there's this sort of idealistic idea of how architecture is going to be used, which somewhat disconnects from the reality of people on the ground and how, you know, and all of the other circumstances. Mm-hmm. So to segue that into Minority Report, you know, what was interesting and triggered the last 15 years of my thinking was that there wasn't a script at the beginning of Minority Report.
Right.
And so that's relatively unusual in film. It's certainly not always the case. But for the designer to come on without a script, with a clear understanding that there is no script, because the writer and I were hired on the same day, it forces you to think differently about that role. Mm-hmm. And it struck me that as a designer, actually the camera is a possibility when you're the designer, right? So the idea, the POV part of it is, right, is a thing you keep in your back pocket to say, how would it be if this was the POV or if this was the POV? But until the camera rolls, you as a designer are actually existing in a spherical narrative space at all possible, you know, all things are possible. That's certainly, you might design a two-wall set because you know the camera's going to be looking in that general direction. Mm-hmm. But on the whole, you're thinking spherically. You're thinking about the possibilities of narrative in a holistic space. My narrative report demanded that that be true to a much, much deeper extent than one is used to as a designer. And it was partly because we couldn't begin to define the world until we actually embraced the narrative constraints. So we were in much more, we were in a situation that was much more similar to that of a writer starting with blank pages of a script. Right. In that we had to sort of say, well, what are the conditions of the world? What's going to drive this world forward? And there were very few. You know, it was Washington, D.C., 2050, precogs at the center.
Right.
As disruptors, and then a certain amount of influence and constraint from Stephen about it being a relatively idealistic future, that it was a sustainable future, a green future, no fossil fuels, that, you know, things worked generally in society. But driven most importantly by this initiative that he put out, which was this provocation he put out, which was that this isn't to be science fiction, it's to be future reality. Mm-hmm. So he wanted this notion, this deep research of like, how would the world really work if you were looking forward 20 or 30 years with the only disruption being this idea of precognitive beings who can predict murder and violent crime. And so that was a component of this idealized society, idealistic society, where people would pour into Washington, D.C. to be under the umbrella of this experiment of the precogs. And then that in itself would create a kind of architectural or urban planning impetus towards a much larger city that had to be built to contain and accommodate this massive influx of population. Right. But all of these were sort of narrative drivers that were being driven largely by environment. So we were thinking about, well, how would a city function if it was very vertical? And it's very vertical because there's a constraint to the limits of the precog's influence, and therefore people are clustering into this center. And the large population has to stay on the other side of the Potomac because you can't build higher than the Capitol building in old DC. And so this very vertical city emerges. So how does that city function? You know, we were able to use the verticality of the city as a metaphor for economic status. So the higher up in the city you lived, the more wealthy you, the more light you got, the more wealthy you were. The lower denizens of the city were more impoverished, and therefore that became a trigger for narrative because right. there was less money being poured into surveillance and advertising and those kind of things that were part and parcel of the way people were being tracked in that society. So you could escape more readily in the lower world, and therefore Tom Cruise heads down, or John Anderson heads down to rebuild his identity. And we were thinking about all of these, you know, things of the consumer society and fashion and architecture, and the fact, for example, in architecture, that a future city is not going to look radically different from a contemporary city. Right. We're not going to knock down every old building in a city.
Just like we don't do today, right?
Exactly. I mean, science fiction is that skyscraper that just got built last week. And right. that's the reality of people looking 10, 15 years out. And so this idea of a very grounded future society that could be tweaked because of some of the needs of the narrative and the fiction, but had to kind of be grounded in a solid base of research and holistic logic, a kind of coherence in its logic in the spherical narrative. All of those things we realized as we as this world kind of unfolded were providing very powerful drivers for story to emerge from that environment, so that you have this capsule for narrative, forgetting my words now, but you're creating this environment that was there to trigger stories, essentially. So we're looking at how stories could be pushed.
But I find that fascinating that happened. I mean, it must be very rare that those locations happen, right? But it is, I mean, if you're looking back to that movie and the concept of it, you are creating such an unusual environment, but yet it all makes so much sense because you guys thought about it way more than normal. You're not just creating a backdrop.
Yeah.
And backdrop is nice, and people make beautiful concept art that illustrate whatever. But I think that so many people focus on character to drive narrative, which makes sense because most story is character driven. But to allow the background to very much influence the foreground. But I think you said that you did it right. I didn't really sense it when I was watching the movie. It was only after I realized like how much stuff I was talking about the world. Mm. Like, oh, do you remember when they were advertising to him as he's walking around, or when he went down and then see the spiders and the this and the that, and just all this stuff that was the environment around this character. The story made sense. It was a great story, but it was a lot of the stuff that was going around, and it was such a rare opportunity.
It really was. Yeah.
And this must have influenced you. This must have been another moment for you, in a sense, that opportunity happened.
Absolutely. I mean, I think and I'm just actually thinking about it fresh as you're asking the question. I think that it's that opportunity when you're building a world from scratch, and it's an it's a container for narrative,
right?
And it's essentially an empty vessel. I mean, you start off with just these very few pointers, but it is actually your curiosity that enriches the world. You know,
right.
That the more that you follow a path into, let's say, advertising. So we were given this privileged access to MIT Media Lab because they were early consultants in the development.
Yeah.
And so we saw all sorts of research being done around tracking and identifying individual people, like this kind of idea of narrowcasting, and mm-hmm. and we saw things like gesture recognition, which became in itself a kind of trope of the film.
Right.
But they became triggers for us to follow and to create narrative possibilities from. And I think it was very much being in a very smart group of people with Steven Spielberg's name at our back to be able to unlock doors into, you know, basically any research space in the country. We were able to kind of ask Apple what they thought about, you know, voice recognition and touchscreen and things like that. Mm-hmm. We were able to talk to DARPA about non-lethal weaponry. We were able to talk to corporations like Lexus about vehicles and vehicle mm-hmm. design, and address, we were working with Frank Gehry's office and mm-hmm. Greg Lynn.
Yeah.
Greg Lynn was enormously influential.
I didn't realize that. Yeah. I've actually met him. When I was at Rice, he was one of the lecturers at Rice.
Yeah.
Fascinating guy.
Greg's wonderful. And actually, you know, one of the questions we had to ask in Minority Report was, how the hell are we going to design architecture of the future with a pencil, mm-hmm. you know, with a drawing board?
Right.
Because ridiculous as it is to imagine, in 1999, there were almost no 3D designers in the film industry.
Right.
We started off as a completely analog art department.
Yep.
We were literally painting with acrylic paint. The concept art was acrylic paint on board, 1999. The very first designers were coming in with a certain amount of good software on their laptops. Mm-hmm. Photoshop and those kind of things were coming in. But we actually went into Greg's studio, saw some of his students using Maya mm-hmm. to design some of the organic architecture that he was promoting, mm-hmm. And had to persuade the union to allow us to hire some of those Maya-based architects.
That was a real challenge at that time. They were actually trying to avoid CAD at all.
Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting.
And so we went, so we became the first all-digital art one by the end of Minority Report.
Wow. But
we couldn't actually have designed the buildings. You know, we could not have designed the cars, and so we were in this interesting cusp, you know, which I think is where we find ourselves again now with the next wave of technology. But that the world demanded certain kinds of narrative outcomes, and as much as the creative content was driven by that, our process was massively driven by those demands. So we realized that we'd started using Previz in at Fight Club.
Right.
So it wasn't new to me.
PLF was doing a lot of the Previz there,
yeah,
right?
PLF was, and...
I remember their story that they did on the, specifically the crash scene and figuring out the camera move through the crash scene on Fight Club.
That's right.
And yeah. And just the idea that the Previz really helped plan out how they were going to shoot that. They could not have figured it out without that Previz.
Yeah.
It was Colin Green, right?
Colin Green, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Colin Green and Ron Frankel.
Right.
And so they both were part of the Minority Report development.
Okay.
And they actually were a big influence on me realizing what tools were available to prototype narrative, mm-hmm. and to prototype environment and character in relation to each other to develop narrative.
Right.
So we invented... something which I've used ever since, but has yet to be really kind of widely adopted, is something called DVIZ, which is...
DVIZ.
DVIZ, which I would... which means design visualization.
Right.
And to me, as a production designer, Previz is preemptive, right? Because Previz is essentially prototyping narrative.
What's already on the script.
Linear narrative, right, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So there is an industry now called Previz, mm-hmm. And it does a lot of work, I would say, much too early on to preemptively develop sequential narrative, linear narrative within the framework of the possibility of a film, much too early.
Right.
To me, the great thing we learned in Minority Report was that we could prototype in 4D, you know, in right. time and space, without knowing anything about what the story was going to be. So we were doing these broad explorations of the possibility of narrative space. And so,
I mean, in a sense, that's a lot what architecture visualization does.
That's right, yeah. Except it's very specifically around what would it feel like to be it, which I'm sure that's true in architecture, too.
Sure.
But one of the characteristics of world building is the human at the center. And is there is an infinite number of possibilities of who that human is.
Okay.
And every time a new human steps into the, you know, a new person steps into the center as a template of possibility, they are steering the narrative in different ways.
Right.
So I think you mentioned VR, and I think the VR is an incredibly important metaphor for that. I think that... immersive theater, like Sleep No More, is an incredibly important
yes.
metaphor for this, which is once a person with specific motivation, and that's got something to do with the way we develop, why narrative is such an important part of the design process, is because we're designing the disruption that comes from a specific set of characteristics in a fictional person that we create in order to test the world. So we create a number of personalities, if you like, who become kind of drone entities, you know, they become entities that one can steer around the world space, but they influence a great deal the way in which the world space has to behave in order to respond to their needs.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I think fiction becomes an enormously important part of world building, is because we have enormous power to say, what if this person, you know,
yeah.
was going off the rails here? You know, what if this person is an anarchist? What if this person is a child in a homeless space? Or what if this person is elderly or a teacher or
right.
whatever the and so There's an opportunity that we have to prototype environment through these lenses, which I think, again, goes beyond what architecture is able to do, because we can push the limits of where those narratives might,
what this really reminds me of is that something I hate, which is the argument of form following function, which is the architecture point of view that's very old school, and a lot of people still think now form must follow function, right? And that implies that the form is not made until the narrative is constructed of that space. And I think that's what you're doing, is you're breaking that down. You're saying, but the function, the form can influence the function so much. You can, the function can completely be altered by how the form is around it. And that exploration allows for a much more free form, in a sense, right?
Yes. I think that's right. I always get confused in the form follows function kind of metaphor or phrase, because mostly because the two are in play. I mean, I think sure. What you're just saying is that what's powerful about prototyping in a narrative environment where it's taken for granted that there's an equal influence between environment and occupant mm-hmm. of the environment, if you like, is that they are constantly pushing against each other, and that we have the opportunity now as narrative designers to develop that relationship from the very first line on the page, if you like, mm-hmm. the very first inceptive thought about the possibility of a world. Those two are pushing against each other. And so what I love about world building, or one of the things I love about world building, is that it works best when there's quite a large group of people asserting influence on it, on the world.
Okay.
And that it's almost impossible to predict the way in which a world is going to emerge and evolve if you are open-minded at the beginning, if you're not trying to say... basically, if you're not following a script, you know, that
right.
if you really acknowledge the idea that story will emerge from this relationship between the kind of volatile components of this holistic spherical world space, that narratives, plural, start growing out of that, and the world changes and the story changes, and literally form and function constantly assert influence on each other.
Exactly.
And in a kind of archigram way, you know, they don't ever stop asserting influence on each other. And we know, you know, the idea that architecture, for example, or environment is inert, and that we just, you know, use it and inhabit it, is old-fashioned for sure. It doesn't respond to anything we know about digital environments, which are obviously volatile at all times. And I have very little experience yet of the game space. Mm-hmm. I'm getting more and more deeply immersed in that because my partners now are Eline Media, who made the amazing game Never Alone, are deeply mm-hmm. knowledgeable game makers, came from Activision. And so our dialogue is constantly about the dynamic between what is good and useful about the film, the kind of linear narrative, and what is good and useful about the interactive immersive narrative mm-hmm. and the tools at our disposal. And one of the things I was forgetting to say about Minority Report, as we were evolving, the idea that we started using Maya, for instance, as a design tool because mm-hmm. the narrative environment demanded it, we discovered, and previous too, we discovered every step of the way that we could, instead of just saying, what can this tool do for us? Follow what the tool's capability is.
Right.
We realized that it was completely in our power to say, this tool needs to change its abilities because it's not satisfying what it is that we need it to do.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I'm really fascinated about with DVIS is that it is actually specifically the space within which you say, what are all of the possibilities available to me? What does the world need? Then we need to combine this tool with this tool. We need to kind of weave together these capabilities, or we need to get on the phone to Unity and ask them if they can write some new code yep. for this possibility. And because we know that that is not only possible, but it's actually enormously desirable to those companies that we're working
Absolutely,
with.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, I work for a software company, and when people come up to us, and that's part of my job, actually, is when people come, it's like, I've got this crazy idea. Is it even possible? It's like, I don't know. And that is what allows our software to evolve and allows the Absolutely. World to evolve from it. And I think the old saying I always love to use is when the only tool you know how to use is a hammer, then all your problems look like nails. Which is basically, yeah. So, I mean, you've got to change your tools and figure out other possibilities you can do with those tools.
Yeah.
And then you're going to make something different.
Absolutely. I mean, it's maddening to me that in parallel for the past, 30 years, the game industry has been developing real-time tools, game mm-hmm. engine platforms that should have been embedded in film 20 years ago.
Sure.
There's no question that right. that film has suffered enormously for not paying attention to the tools that would have been available to it in the game industry.
Right.
And but still, film's still one of the most conservative industries. Now that I work with many different industries,
right.
really one of the most conservative industries that we work with, because, well, it's very volatile. It's high risk. You can't take a lot of risk at the beginning, but we try over and over again to insert completely new technologies in the front end of film. Mm-hmm. And there's huge resistance to it, as there was with resistance to CAD or resistance to, right. Previs was based in animation. That's ridiculous. It should have been based in a game platform. It would make no sense at all that Previs wasn't real time.
Right.
And it's only now, since really we set in motion something for Jungle Book that was implemented as...
I'm familiar with the project, actually.
Did you?
Yeah.
You worked?
Yeah. No, I didn't, but I'm familiar with how they work on that, obviously.
Yeah. So we brought a few elements together, mm-hmm. the virtual camera,
yep.
The game engine, yep. Some of the work that was coming out of Houdini, and in the end we didn't end up working on the project, but mm-hmm. but we were able to put a few of those pieces in place, and they did run with it, and you begin to see that if you can create, procedural jungle mm-hmm. around a character with a real-time virtual camera,
yeah.
and you can run characters that have collision
detection
built mm-hmm. in, and you can start manipulating pathways and passageways. You're in an immersive theater kind of development space.
Absolutely.
Which is far more creative than waiting for the animation assets to come back through Maya.
There's a project that I worked on. I'll try to make it brief, but it's basically centered around virtual production, because one of the things that my software does is actually a ray tracer, right? So we do ray tracing, which is a very traditionally, very photorealistic rendering, not traditionally real time because of the amount of computation it takes to make ray tracing it work. But we've developed a certain way to use GPU rendering and some other things that we were actually able to get ray tracing to be at about 24 frames a second. And that was important for a specific guy who came up to us, similar story. He's like, what if I could ray trace that fast? How much hardware do I need to make that happen? Mm-hmm. Because he wanted to explore the space much more like the way light really acts in certain conditions of ray tracing. And so we worked on that technology, and it opened up the doors. And I spoke to some of the guys who had worked on Jungle Book, and I'm like, well, that you guys are going in a direction that we ultimately want to be, because the DP has a role to play
mm-hmm.
as someone who's actually lighting, but in a virtual sense, right?
Absolutely.
And I think that those DPs specifically are so talented because they've been doing it for so long and have got such great vision, but we're still relegating the lighting and the narrative and the composition by people way down the line and yeah. waiting for that result. It's much better to have it live. And I agree with you. I think yeah. that live virtual production should eventually just be called production.
I totally agree. And I think there's been, to some extent, a negative influence asserted by post-production on virtual production. Mm. Because I think that post-production, visual effects as an industry, for example, actually doesn't have a sophisticated understanding of the front end of development. Mm-hmm. And I had an amazing experience working for a while on episode 9, where I was working hand in hand with the research team at ILM, mm-hmm. and where we were developing VR as an experiential development tool, yep. at the front end. Completely logical, and plenty of people have tried it now. But we were able to literally hand in hand with them say, yeah, but what if we could do this? What if we could do that? And they were had the best kind of game designers and coders, mm-hmm. working with us. And we were developing new possibilities for the tool sets in real time almost, mm-hmm. and pushing forward with this idea that this virtual production is actually the first step you take into experiencing the possibility of the inceptive design phase, the possibility of being inside that design space. It's completely logical to me that for myself as a designer, I want to be able to step into the raw, you know, the wireframe of that environment,
right.
before it's developed really at all, to be able to sense, you know, what's the scale feel like, what's the depth feel like, what's the distance, how the portals feel in relation to the distance you have to travel inside an environment. Those tools are so clearly available to us now, mm-hmm. That we have definitely being able to flip the model on its head. Like most of the time we're doing our concept art after we've walked through the environment, right. and know it well, right? And then right. we pull the camera down inside the VR space and we choose our lens and we find a frame and we shoot the frame and then we port that out to the concept artist, mm-hmm. and they're now painting over incredibly crude wireframe environment that is frame accurate, that is depth accurate, that is scale accurate,
yep.
that even has the early phase stages of light in it, and you know where the light's coming from, etc. The trick, and I think people in film are still very scared of this, is the idea that it's going to become a free-for-all. You know, well, if you could do that, then who's ever going to kind of where's self-discipline going to come from, that you need this sort of very strict linear process in order to work your way through these things and pass it off from hand to hand. And
do you think that's just habit?
I think it's a lack of sophistication of the understanding of the tools and what they can do.
Interesting.
It is habit too, I think definitely. But I think the great DPs are not scared of digital, for example, of the virtual. Right. As a designer, you know, I'm incredibly driven to building physical sets where the actors are standing. Mm-hmm. So I'm not by any means promoting like, let's replace all analog with digital. But I'm extremely interested as a designer in knowing exactly where those edges lay, being able to in real time extend and contract and move that space around virtually in prototyping, in planning, so that I know that I've built in the most efficient way possible. I've built the sets where it's economic to build the sets, mm-hmm. where the actors feel like they really are engaged in real environment.
Sure.
On Man of Steel, we had a great relationship with the actors because we built a huge amount of sets in that movie, as much right. as it's a big visual effects film. And it was really economic to do so because you got shot after shot off from the same assets. And you build it high enough to make sure that whatever it is, 60% of your shoot can take place within the constraints of the physical environment. Mm-hmm. And then when you do extend it, you extend it because you have to and you really know you're going to make the most of it. But I think the putting the DP, I think that thing of self-discipline, what we did in episode 9 was to say, remove all kind of modern nomenclature, digital nomenclature from this. Let's call everything by the names that are familiar in terms of habit. So mm-hmm. when you put on the VR helmet, you're scouting, you know, you're going to scout a new environment. When you want to see the camera move, you can lay track. Mm-hmm. You choose prime lenses, you grab your camera, you block your characters, you drive your characters through the frame, you cast, et cetera, et cetera. And if you go through the steps in the virtual production process as you would in the physical production process, everybody understands intuitively that you can't just, some sets you can move around, but that landscape was built from photogrammetry from a real location. You can't change that mountain. Sorry, you got
right.
Some of these things are fixed, and some things take a long time to adapt, and some things are quick to do in real time, and you kind of get an instinct for that. And the director we were working with at the time, Colin Trevorrow, he and I both left the film in the end, but he totally got it. He stepped inside and he was blocking the first 15 pages of the film was blocked. He knew it. He said, on the first production meeting after he'd been into VR, he said, well, I've been to the location, so I understand it completely. Right. So it's the creatives in film can completely, obviously don't need to make any distinction between the digital and the mm-hmm. and the analog. Their imagination has been playing in this space for a long time already anyway. It's just we have an amazing opportunity to do something completely different around virtual production, as you say.
I think that what's interesting to me is I find that virtual production is not just for film. The technology that goes into virtual production is going to influence so much of even outside of film. Architecture is a specific example. People are going to want to explore architecture before it's being built, right? People are going to want to design a car or figure out what a car looks like or experience it to scale correctly before it's done. And that all of that now, is going to center around what became virtual production.
Yeah.
And I think that that becomes very influential. Going back to what we're thinking about in terms of Minority Report, to this very day, a lot of the ideas that you guys ciphered from the world and influence and put it into that film has continued to influence us to this very day, where we still look to films like Minority Report or 2001 and say, that's a vision of the future. That's something that I see as the future, right? From the gesture stuff that we were talking about earlier, which honestly speaking, I still don't think the gesture thing would work. I think that I still think micro movements are going to be more ergonomic than large movements, but that's just my own,
okay.
my own feeling about
it. It's working pretty well out in the world right
well,
now.
Well, I just feel that I'm not going to be designing with large movements in my hand.
Interesting. Yeah.
But I...
Have you been to Oblong?
No, but I want to see it. I mean, I'm absolutely sure. I'm willing to be told otherwise or shown otherwise. But I still think there's a lot of things in terms of facial recognition, the way that advertising works. All of those things are happening. They are
absolutely.
Happening right now. I
absolutely.
Go to Facebook, it's advertising to me very directly. And so it knows who I am as a persona and it has all these things. So the way that you have created these worlds and created these environments is so much more influential on the world beyond the screen that I think that it is a clear example of where filmmaking has an incredible role to play in terms of the influence of the world around us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the biggest reasons why I think that, architects look to films and people who came up, futurists and all those things, come up to those people and like, that's my vision of the future, because when I was a kid, I saw that.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is what I want to do. And I think that those thought process is really important. And what frustrates me is a lot of people, when they're thinking about making their own films or their own games or whatever, the first thing they do is they design a character. They don't design the world around it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I totally agree with you. I think that there's something, There's a couple of media that I think are incredibly influential on all of us more than we realize. And obviously film is one of them. Mm-hmm. I think film design is specifically, to me, and I'm obviously prejudiced, but I think that film design is interesting because it exists in this space that is to do with environmental conception, that's focused on environment first, so that you don't start automatically with character necessarily in film design.
Right.
But it is always responding to the population of the environment that you're building. So I think film occupies this space that is very easy to move sideways, to move into architectural theater or into game or into, in terms of film design. I think that there's a very interesting possibility of a common language in that narrative design space, which I've realized increasingly as I've really left the film industry and gone into teaching and gone into other industries, that there isn't actually anything out there that's much like film design in the sense that you have this absolute freedom around fiction or the importance of fiction in one's process, which I would continue to stress as being a major part of the craft. Mm-hmm. And yet the need to tangibly reach outcome, to build architecturally, to build physically, to build virtually. Like, you have to satisfy all of these different production criteria, so you become deeply immersed in the tools, and you have to constantly populate it with characters who can exist in the past, the present, and the future. So you're dealing with four-dimensional space. And I've had a company prior to this company, Experimental, called 5D, mm-hmm. because we believe deeply in the idea that we've moved from the point in space to the line to the plane to the volume plus time plus story. And the fifth dimension is narrative, and is the thing that drives the occupant through that four-dimensional time-based volumetric space. But I think that it's this idea that we can move very freely across the membranes of these different industries by kind of asking the questions around narrative, right, in each of these different spaces. That in architecture, absolutely, but the project we're doing right now with Ford, for example, which is building a city of tomorrow,
right,
we've worked now for 2 years inside a meta city that is a city of possibilities of the future,
yep,
but being driven very much like Minority Report was, being driven by the influence of what could really happen. How much of this is based in, very importantly for a company like Ford, in the reality of how far forward can we project legitimately?
Right.
And each step, incremental step of the way, never forgetting the past and the historical precedent and the historical framework. Because if you move into a city, on the whole, you're not building it from the ground up. You're building it in relation to all sorts of socio-economic, cultural, political strictures that are framing every decision you make. So you have to be responsive to this volumetric space that is very much based in a historical narrative.
Right.
So future, one of the classes that's taught at USC is working with a group around Afrofuturism and uses the Sankofa bird as a symbol, and the Sankofa bird flies forward while it looks backwards.
Okay.
I think it's a beautiful metaphor for how we should be thinking about, you know, our place in developing kind of future narrative space. But I was just going to mention this project that now I teach at USC since 2012, and one of the projects that we are unfolding in my lab, in the World Building Media Lab, is called Project Tesseract.
Okay.
And the idea of Tesseract is to say it's our responsibility as teachers to look at all of the available tool sets and all the available craft skills across a broad range of different industries and skill sets and fold them together now. Now we can. We don't have to think that you know, this is a film school, or therefore we'll teach using certain cameras and, right, certain editorial condition, etc., that actually pulling a game engine in, is one thing. Using story development from animation, for example, mm-hmm. where you have a story room with lots of writers and all artists all drawing that story before there's ever a script, for example. Right. Right. So animation's really useful. The front end of theater, incredibly valuable. Architectural visualization, all of these things can fall together. So we're really trying to make a concerted effort now to say no tools are off limit. I was just doing the live show for Ford at CES, working with amazing.
I saw it online, so it was really cool to see that.
And there's a tool or set of tools they use there for live, which are live theater tools for syncing and bringing in, multiple different alphas onto a live performance or a live backdrop mm-hmm. That has to respond to the performer or the speaker on stage. And so triggering the complexity of something that is pulling from a huge array of different visual input and triggering them so that they all fire off perfectly, that could be tied to lighting and could be tied to sound. So that's a tool I hadn't come across before.
Right.
That, to my mind, is, well, that's a perfect tool for us to be doing, live previs, like improv. We were talking about, you were mentioning earlier about why we're not bringing cinematography, for example, into previs or into design visualization at right. the front end. One of the things that makes me crazy is that sound isn't engaged in the front end of virtual production.
Right.
That it's incredibly rare. I have yet to meet the sound designer on a film.
They are always the last thought.
And it makes no sense at all. Right. But the sound designer has such an enormous influence. And that relationship, and we begin to start engaging that more and more in game design or in theatrical design, mm-hmm. that's an incredibly volatile, interesting relationship. Is the sound designer asking, well, what's the quality of the materials that are in the space? What is this, right. So we undermine and compromise our ability to do good work mm-hmm. if we don't make better use of the tools available to us.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're going a little bit long, so I don't want to necessarily sure. take up too much more of your time, but this was a fascinating talk, and I'd love to hear more about some of the projects you're doing. I'm obviously going to be following you. Is there places that people can go to see some of your work that they would get more influence on? So where can you mention some of those?
Yeah, I mean, the experimental design site is experimental.design, and that's going to... It's very, we're just really sort of building all of that right now. But in the next month or so, that's going to be fairly rich in terms of our current work. Uh-huh. The World Building Media Lab and the World Building Institute at USC, both of those websites are full of projects we've done. So the World Building Institute is the kind of outreach of world building in that we do, for example, I'm on my way to Berlin next month. We do every year at the Berlin Film Festival, we do a workshop around narrative design around a specific set of, sort of political or social questions that one might ask. Mm-hmm. Right now, my class, that workshop and a number of workshops that we'll do this year are focused on the street corner as a microcosm, and we're asking the question, what if a single street corner could change the world? And using a street corner as a systemic way to think about the volatile intersection of multiple different human conditions in an urban setting. So all of that's going to be on the World Building Institute and the World Building Media Lab site. And I'll just mention one project that we're doing in the World Building Media Lab, which you can check out on that site, which has been fascinating. For the last year, we've been working with a group called The Bridge, led by a visionary doctor called Dr. Ray Stevens, mm-hmm. who is a molecular biologist and is trying to open up the dialogue between the kind of very esoteric and closed system of molecular biology to other sciences and arts, actually. And so we've been developing a virtual reality environment that examines a single pancreatic beta cell as if it was a city.
Oh, wow.
So we're using the metaphor of a city to examine the behavior of proteins inside pancreatic beta cell, and using the organic behavior of proteins and the rules and conditions of a cell to see if that can indeed have an influence on the way that cities develop. So it's a fantastic research project. We're just in the very first early stages of it, but it's really interesting. We've had to develop metaphors. I mean, apart from anything else, one of the biggest constant challenges and the most exciting parts about world building is that you have to create common language for multiple different people to be able to speak to each other. And so in this particular space, we had to get artists and scientists to develop a common language. It took a better part of a year to even find enough common language to be able to have a kind of dialogue that would move things forward. Right. But I'm very excited about the possibilities now, particularly as we start breaking outside just the kind of narrative arts and right. start looking at forming relationships with, with scientists and engineers and with social and economic planning. And, you know, there's such a fantastic possibility for when these collaborative relationships can go, given the tools we have, given the possibilities of collaboration that we have.
Yeah, well, that's amazing. I will put those links up on the site as well, so people can check us out. Thank you so much for your time, Alex. This has been fascinating.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure. Thank you.
Cheers.